I wanted and all I want is to be able to do the work I do without fear of reprisal and intimidation and hostility and repression of free speech. That's all.
A University of Alaska professor says he was muzzled for criticizing the oil industry. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 27th of October. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an Alaska writer's books will become a new television series.
My dream is that we find an Alaska Native actress. I'm pretty stubborn, and we're going to look, and we're going to hope we're going to find her.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Connect with Alaska businesses seeking qualified Alaskans for hundreds of jobs in oil and gas, healthcare, and dozens of other career fields by visiting Alexis, the state of Alaska's virtual career center. When you register at alexsys.alaska.gov, your experience and qualifications will be matched with real-time job postings from Alaska employers. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
University of Alaska professor Rick Steiner says he intends to resign his job at the University of Alaska because he believes President Mark Hamilton is not standing behind his promises of academic freedom. Steiner's union has decided not to send his grievance to arbitration. Hamilton denied the grievance earlier this month. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
Rick Steiner is well known to Alaska reporters for advocacy on environmental issues. He says it's part of his job. There have been complaints about his advocacy for years, but until recently his superiors stood behind him. Steiner works for the Marine Advisory Program, which is a sort of ocean-based version of the cooperative extension agencies that every state land-grant university has to spread college knowledge to farmers and homemakers, or in this case, coastal communities and fishermen. Steiner's profile rose during the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill when he worked with Cordova fishermen and the state to jumpstart a spill response. The state made the fishermen their partners in the joint command that was formed with Exxon and the Coast Guard. Steiner continued to push for better spill prevention and deployment of response equipment, predicting trouble in the Aleutians just days before the Celandang IU spill. His latest clash with authority came last year when he signed on to a letter from Bristol Bay organizations questioning the university sponsoring talks about how oil leasing and fishing in Bristol Bay can be compatible, talks that were partially funded by Shell Oil. Steiner's participation in the protest raised an eyebrow at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which foots part of the bill for the university's extension work. Jim Murray, then deputy director of NOAA's Sea Grant Program, complained to University School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences Dean Dennis Weisenberg, who agreed with Murray's insistence that extension people are supposed to be neutral, and yanked the grant that paid part of Steiner's salary. University spokeswoman Kate Ripley says that was not an infringement on Steiner's academic freedom because they found another source to pay him with.
So when this was raised as an issue by NOAA and the Sea Grant, pointed out the neutral brokers of information, you know, pointed out the, what's in the handbook, et cetera, the university decided, well, if that's a concern for NOAA and Sea Grant, we will just fund that 1 month of funding that that Rick was receiving under the NOAA Sea Grant out of university funds.
Steiner says that funding decision is beside the point. With or without it, there was a pattern of intimidation. He thinks Dean Weisenberg should have simply told Murray he was out of line.
Obviously, you cannot start giving a grant-making institution the authority to tell a faculty member that receives those grants what they can and can't say.
Steiner says the way his job is paid for now, there is no assurance there will be funding in future years. Ripley says, as far as she knows, Steiner's funding is not specifically under threat, but she's not about to predict a future university budget.
There's university systems that are cutting like 20-30% right in faculty and in programs. So I'm certainly not going to go on record saying that nothing ever in the future of any department will be cut, including him. I just can't know what the future's going to hold.
Steiner had multiple grievances. This latest one was taken through four steps. Acting for President Hamilton, University General Counsel Roger Bruner says that Steiner seems to have trouble taking direction and wants to free himself from supervision. Steiner says it's clear to him that the direction he's been getting from his superiors is to stop criticizing the oil industry, and there seems no further appeal for him.
That doesn't seem likely at this point, so I will be leaving the university at some point this winter.
Steiner says Hamilton has made many statements supporting academic freedom, but hasn't lived up to them. But speaking for Hamilton, Ripley says academic freedom is not what the Steiner case is about.
Academic freedom is reaffirmed at the university all the time. And this grievance hasn't been an issue from our viewpoint as one of academic freedom or freedom of speech.
Bruner's ruling on the grievance says that Steiner's supervisor had no improper motive in reassigning him, but may have been a bit imprecise in distinguishing between job performance and what he terms viewpoint concerns protected under a policy of academic freedom. Steiner says he's not trying to write his own job description, but just trying to keep it.
All I wanted and all I want is to be able to do the work I do without fear of reprisal and intimidation and hostility and repression of free speech. That's all. That they were not able to provide that for me is a real sad commentary on where this university is these days.
Steiner's case has been picked up by the national organization Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. Peers Jeff Rook says they've asked NOAA head Jane Lubchenco to clarify the guidelines for Sea Grant personnel. They say this appears to be the first time federal grant funding for a university faculty member was terminated due to the faculty member's comments. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Alaska writer Dana Stabenow's popular Kate Chugach mystery books will be the basis for a television series being developed by Evergreen Films. The announcement was made today at Evergreen's post-production facility in the hills above Anchorage. Mike Devlin is one of Evergreen Films' owners. He says the company has been looking for different film projects in Alaska, and the main thing they wanted was a dramatic television series.
The reason that's important from a business point of view is that a television series, a dramatic series, tends to be executed about 10 months a year. So unlike a normal film where you might come in and shoot for 40, 45 days, this is the kind of show where we'll be up here shooting each episode in 7 or 8 days over the course of an entire year. So it'll be 9, 10 months of shooting up here. We'll be employing crew, using the infrastructure, looking for sound stages, but also shooting on locations, various interior and exterior locations around Alaska.
In Stabenow's prolific book series, Kate Chugach is an Alaska Native private investigator who solves murders throughout the state. The first book in what is now 17 in the series was released in 1991. Dana Stabenow said today that offers started coming in 1993 for film options on her books, but she refused them all because they would not agree to film in Alaska.
I've been saying no for so long to so many people who had expressed interest in the screen rights to the Kate Chugach series that I wasn't sure I knew how to say yes.
She says she's stubborn, and Alaska is very much part of the character of her stories.
It was very important to me that it was Alaska on screen with Kate and Mutt, and not Central Washington State, and not British Columbia, and not New Zealand. You know, we look pretty good, and I think it's very important. It wasn't an option for me not to sell out. It just wasn't an option for me to sell it to anybody who wouldn't shoot it here.
Alaska has been the subject of many films and even television series in the past, but very little, if any, of the actual film work was done in the state. Senator Johnny Ellis was at the event today to talk up the Alaska Film Incentive Program, which he sponsored legislation for in 2008. The program provides between 30% and 44% tax credit incentives for companies doing film work in the state. Ellis says a recent car commercial being shot in Fairbanks and the upcoming Kate Chugach television series are great indicators of growing interest in making films in Alaska. Stabenow was all smiles today as her dream of seeing her characters on film in Alaska was realized. They're a long way from casting the program, but Stabenow has high hopes for who will play her heroine, Kate.
My dream is that we find an Alaska Native actress. That's my dream. And, you know, I'm pretty stubborn. And we're going to look, and we're going to hope we're going to find her.
Evergreen Films' facility is impressive. The 3,000-square-foot production area is what Devlin calls a digital intermediate screening room that he says is a 2 and 3D digital system.
It's higher quality than your normal cinema because we're doing color grading and effects and so forth, so we need to have, you know, the true colors and everything. But we do that here before we send it off to either we produce what's called a digital cinema package to go to digital theaters, or send it to Technicolor or somebody like that to do a film out to go to film. So we can do pretty much everything from the earliest story development all the way through production, filming, offline editing, and finishing right here in Alaska in this facility, which makes it a lot more attractive for producers coming up from LA or for doing our own projects.
Devlin says the Kate Chugach television series is in the early stages of development, but they hope to start actual casting and filming work sometime between summer 2010 and 2011. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, looking at the history of commercial whaling in the 1800s.
So they thought that they were doing good works, the Lord's good works, by going off and killing whales.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the new AT&T, your world delivered. Elks National Foundation, in conjunction with the Alaska State Elks Association and local lodges, is offering the Most Valuable Student MVS Scholarship for high school seniors. These scholarships are awarded to graduating high school seniors through a local, state, and national competition and are based on scholarship, leadership, and financial need. Information and applications at elks.org/ENF. Application deadline is November 2nd. This message sponsored by the Alaska Elks Association.
Haynes is looking at heating burrow buildings with wood. Experts are preparing a feasibility study examining the pros and cons of the change. Tara Bicknell reports from the Upper Lynn Canal community.
Paul Weisner is with CE2 Engineers in Anchorage and is one of the people working on the study. Weisner really got involved in the wood heat discussion last summer to help the borough put together an application for the Alaska Energy Authority to begin the feasibility study. But the look into the world of wood heat started long before that. And not just for Haynes, but many towns who are affected by rising fuel prices and interested in alternative technologies.
The main thing that's happened is the price trauma, you say, from oil. People do a lot of planning, especially municipalities. They plan, they budget for electricity, they budget for heating oil, they budget for all this stuff. And then when you have events that happen, like with the oil, how it spiked, can literally devastate, especially villages in rural Alaska, small communities like Haynes. I mean, it affects everybody, but it really, really hits. So people are looking for alternatives, and they also want environmentally responsible alternatives. The other thing is that oil, if we say natural gas, oil, and propane, they're pretty nice fuels. I mean, we've got a whole technology. It's easy to handle them. You know, they can be handled with a minimal amount of labor and trouble. And so when you burn something like wood, which is a more complicated molecule, you have to earn your burn, so to speak.
The idea of using wood to heat burrow buildings is much more modern than building fireplaces all over town. Wood heat technology has advanced to include a wide range of state-of-the-art systems in place in many parts of the United States.
We're looking at probably using a chip system because of the volume. Okay, one of the things that they wanted to do was to have something that's automated. They don't want somebody doing a bunch of stoking and stuff and a lot of labor. So that narrows the field down to either chips or pellets.
To complete the study, Weisner and his firm are working with Nathan Rotz and his employer, CTA Architects Engineers in Missoula, Montana. Rotz says he's worked on a lot of wood heat projects and has seen some great successes. But it doesn't always work. That's the point of the feasibility study, says Rotz.
We've done probably 120 of these, and out of that, in the end, we only have 20 projects that were completed. So we want to look at what's going to affect it, what are the project costs, and is it really economically viable? I think there's a lot of strong support within the community, but that being said, there does have to be an economic reason to do this. You know, the borough will have information then to be able to make decisions down the line.
There are several factors that engineers use to determine if the project is economically feasible. Weisner says that includes Haynes' strengths and weaknesses.
We've got to see if the biomass that we have available, you might say the universe of realistic possibilities, can work. So the first choice, of course, is the local wood. And We have plenty of wood here. That's not an issue. The issue that we see is the primary issue is moisture.
The more moisture in the wood, the more wood it takes to dry the fuel. But the feasibility study could shed some light on whether that balance is an economically sensible one. Some residents are worried about the changes that could accompany a decision to pursue wood heat, like industrial development and air quality.
When you make a building, it's sort of an industrial building. You can make it look nice. You're bringing in vehicles with chips or you're doing something, so you have to take that into account. The other thing is, as far as emissions go, we're very concerned about air quality. But the first thing is, if you see a bunch of smoke coming out, that means you're wasting energy. It's not just a health thing, but you're wasting energy. You should have that your combustion system set and designed so it burns real clean.
The first solid results from the Haynes Wood Heat Feasibility Study will be available within 2 weeks, but the final study is expected to be complete by the end of the year.
Fairbanks' first LED streetlights are up and running. Fairbanks Metropolitan Area Transportation System, or FMATS coordinator Donna Gardino, says the energy-saving lights were installed as part of larger upgrade projects. She says light from the LEDs is noticeably different from that emitted by the older technology they replace.
It's really a complicated process as to say whether they're brighter or not, but in my eye, it seemed clearer and crisper than the high-pressure sodium, which had more of a glow to them.
Gardino says national studies are in the works to better define the quality of LED lighting and what it means for driver safety. The state recently put out requests for bids for the replacement of up to 3,000 streetlights in the cities of Fairbanks and North Pole. But Gardino says the LED installations are being restricted to side streets and neighborhoods.
They're still doing a lot of research as to what the spacing needs to be on the LED lights compared to high-pressure sodium, for example. And that's just one of the technical aspects that the engineers are looking into. And that's why, to maintain safety, we want to make sure that we're just putting the LED lights out where there's low volume, low-speed traffic.
LED street light conversions are happening across the country to save energy. FMATS Gardino says it's estimated that the cost of running streetlights in Fairbanks will drop between 20% to 40% once all the LEDs are installed. The Fairbanks and North Pole projects are expected to cost $5 million. Gardino says the work could be completed this winter, depending on the contractor selected.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. And by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
Former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin is reporting that she has received at least $1.25 million for her hugely anticipated upcoming book, Going Rogue. A disclosure statement released today discusses Palin's finances from January 1st to July 27th, when she resigned as Alaska governor. The former Republican vice presidential nominee says she received $1.25 million retainer from publisher HarperCollins for the book. The document only provides a partial picture of the book deal because it doesn't cover the 3 months she has been out of office. A dwindling energy supply, frantic efforts to replace it, even a pipeline. These elements may sound familiar to us today, but they are also echoes from events in Alaska 140 years ago. Peter Nichols' new book, Final Voyage, traces the end of commercial whaling in the United States and draws chilling parallels to our own time. APRN's Ellen Lockyer reports.
Earlier this year, Barrow whaling captains had a hard time getting their umiaks out to the whaling grounds due to a persistent ridge of sea ice pushed close to shore by contrary winds. But in the fall of 1871, 40 square-rigged whaling ships off Alaska's northwest coast faced the same problem. Massive ridges of sea ice pushed toward the beach by prevailing winds. The boats, confined to a narrow channel, were eventually pushed aground.
there was nowhere else to go for commercial quantities of whales and whale oil than Alaska in 1871. So New Bedford had sent all of its ships up there, most of them. And of the 40-vessel fleet in the area, 32 of them were pinned against the coast by an unexpected change of wind that pushed the ice offshore onto shore and trapped these ships and crushed them.
That's author Peter Nichols. Grounding meant certain destruction for the commercial whaling ships and their crews. And in his book, Final Voyage, Nichols says the 1871 incident, in which more than 1,200 men and women had to be rescued from the ice as winter closed in, marked the death knell for American whaling.
Had whale oil still been a healthy business, had it not been supplanted or in the process of being supplanted by petroleum, they would simply have rebuilt ships and gone back. But they were just hanging on. So almost overnight, whaling was finished.
In his book, Nichols traces the rise of commercial whaling from the first dead whale washed up on the beach on Nantucket Island in the early 17th century to the ascendance of New Bedford, Massachusetts as the whaling capital of the world.
New Bedford became the Houston in Saudi Arabia of the whale oil business, and that little town became the richest town in the world by the mid 19th century. That mirrored very much the economic conditions today when that collapsed, when whale oil collapsed in New Bedford. Whale oil was collapsing around the world, and as our economies today are collapsing here and abroad, and people were just amazed and had not seen it coming.
Whale oil fueled the Industrial Revolution in England and later became indispensable in the United States. But times change, and even as whale oil replaced tallow as a lubricant for early machines, an energy upstart challenged whale oil's supremacy as entrepreneurs flocked to Titusville, Pennsylvania to cash in on the gushing rock oil finds there in the later 19th century. Petroleum, initially considered only a cure-all for ailments, soon was carried by pipeline to refineries and promoted as the alternative to smelly, rancid, and increasingly hard to get whale oil. Nichols says the collapse of commercial whaling was unthought of at the time, even as the entire globe was denuded of whales by an industry that did nothing to ensure its own sustainability.
One of the reasons that whaling was so successful in first Nantucket and then New Bedford was that it for them, it was a holy directive straight out of the Bible, which said, slay the great Leviathan and you're doing the Lord's work. So they thought that they were doing good works, the Lord's good works, by going off and killing whales. And then secondly, they really didn't think of whales as an animal or certainly not any sort of sentient creature the way we do today. Whales were simply floating oil barrels in the sea.
In a bit of historical irony, it was two whalemen who stumbled on petroleum on Alaska's northern coast, even as the flame was flickering on the whaling era.
They went ashore with guns to find food, and they came across this black lake, and they put a match to it, and it turned into flame. They had found the seeping surface of the huge Prudhoe Bay oil reserves.
One of the men, Charles Brower, left his mark on Barrow, as has the petroleum industry. Peter Nichols' book, Final Voyage, is available in hardcover. A paperback version will come out next year. For APRN, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
A group of scientists have developed a new device that can tell how, when, and where a stellar sea lion died. Preliminary data from 5 sea lions in Prince William Sound shows they were killed by predators. KUCB's Ann Hillman spoke with the principal investigator.
Pinnipet ecologist Marcus Horning from Oregon State University worked with colleagues at the Alaska Sea Life Center to implant tags into juvenile sea lions. Each tag records the animal's temperature and other information, then stores it inside the unit until the animal dies. When the tags are exposed, they send all of the information through a satellite back to a lab. Horning says they can tell how the animal died by how quickly its body temperature changed.
So we get about a day's worth of temperature, body core temperature data, before the animal dies, and then a day's worth after, which tells us how rapidly the carcass cools, or conversely, if the tag comes out of the body right away, if it's presumably dismembered by a predator, we see an almost instantaneous temperature drop.
Horning tagged 27 animals total and has received information on the deaths of 5 of them. The data shows that 4 of the 5 were killed by predators.
3 of the 4 instances, the temperature dropped instantaneously. The tags also have a light sensor, and they tell us that they saw light. And the final bit of information is how soon after the event the tags begin uplinking to a satellite. And in those instances, they uplinked immediately at the next opportunity.
In the 4th instance, the cooling rate was different.
From those cooling rates, we deducted that the one animal in question, which weighed about 150 kilograms at time of release, must have been dismembered because the cooling rate that we recorded corresponds to a chunk of tissue of about 24 kilograms.
A technical malfunction impaired full data retrieval from the 5th animal. Horning says other satellite tags on some of the mammals showed that they were diving in the water and behaving normally up until their deaths. This supports the conclusion that they were killed by predators instead of by starvation or disease. Horning emphasizes, however, that with data on only 5 animals, not much can be said about the overall cause of death or population decline for Stellar sea lions.
Really, what we're looking at now is an initial first measure of predation rates on very young animals in one location and just right now. I think there's a danger that people might jump to conclusion that this supports the theory that the decline of the Stellars might have been caused by killer whales. And we certainly cannot say that, and that would be not a justified conclusion.
He also says that the cause of death and even the type of predator that eats sea lions could vary from region to region.
And at this stage, I would say also the fact that we have this very coarse initial estimate, simply a very high predation rate, possibly, simply serves as a wake-up call that we really should probably take a close look at predation. But that's all we can say at this point.
Horning says that about 50% of sea lions die before they reach 5 years old because of high infant and juvenile mortality. That's before and soon after many females are old enough to reproduce.
The early years of the life of a sea lion are very challenging, not just because of predation, but also because of the need to feed yourself. And the transition from maternal support through lactation to independent diving and hunting is very difficult.
Horning says they still need to do more research on sea lions and other marine mammal deaths and on predators before drawing any firm conclusions. But the ratio of traumatic deaths in the early data is striking. All of the sea lions were tagged in Prince William Sound, an area where killer whales are known to eat the endangered mammals. Stellar sea lions are protected species all along the coast of Alaska. I'm Ann Hillman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Tara Bicknell in Haines, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ann Hillman in Unalaska. APRN Steve Heimel and Ellen Lockyer reported from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Gooseberry Peter, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender. GrantStation, your fast track to funding, on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years.
And by
Condor Airlines, offering nonstop service to Frankfurt from Anchorage and Fairbanks between May and September, with connections to most German and European destinations. Details available at condor.com. If heating your home costs more than you can manage and you have a low income, the state of Alaska has heating assistance programs that may help. The programs have expanded to include families with a higher household income. For information or an application form, call 1-800-470-3058 or visit heatinghelp.alaska.gov. Sometimes a little help makes all the difference. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.